Hey, Megan, Dr. G here with SPKN, and today we have joining us Dr. Sylvie Perron, full professor in the Department of Physical Education at Université Laval. Sylvie is the research chair for safety and integrity in sport. Her recent research focuses on measuring the prevalence of violence towards athletes and associated risk factors, as well as the impact on the physical and mental health of young athletes. Sylvie, welcome to SPKN.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
As we start our discussion today, we must admit that child maltreatment in sport is an undeniable problem. Cases such as those of Larry Nassar in the US, the UK football sexual abuse scandal, and the case of the ski coach Bertrand Chéret in Canada shed light on the disturbing fact that young athletes are certainly vulnerable to maltreatment. Sylvie, due to the lack of consensus on the appropriate term, so we have coach abuse, athlete abuse, non-accidental violence, harassment, bullying, and as well as different definitions of maltreatment in sport, why don't you start us off with just a basic, what is coach abuse? What is maltreatment?
This is a very good question because, as you mentioned, there is a lot of terminology that go out there about those topics around safe sport and violence problematic in sport. One thing that I can say is that the better way I feel to do it is have an umbrella term. And here we all talk about violence. So violence is a more wide concept or umbrella concept, and it was proposed by the World Health Organization, a definition that is quite simple in the sense that it covers like the utilization or use of physical force or power against us directly, so we can do violence to us directly, or another person, so interpersonal violence, or a group of person. So, and the kinds of violence could be categorized in four forms. So it could be sexual, physical, psychological, or neglect. So inside this big umbrella, we can see that depending on the context, depending on who is the perpetrator and who is the victim, we can have different terms that come in. So for example, if we look like at bullying, we especially know that it's more likely to be used between peer-to-peer kind of violence. So it will be named, in this case, bullying. So sometimes when we use maltreatment, it's referring to a person in a position of authority regarding a person that is under this authority. So for example, the coach versus the athletes. So we can use maltreatment in that place. But there is no like fairly big consensus all around the researchers around this. So this is why there is a lot of use of different terminology. So yeah, but the World Health Organization is more and more used definition in sport now.
This is a fairly basic or foundational definition and conceptualization that anybody, any scientist, any person, any politician would have to engage with to understand and define what they're actually talking about. So words like violence, abuse, maltreatment, bullying can all be used and have been used in different ways. Yeah. And, you know, it, in my reading of the literature as well, too, is that it is continuing to adapt and change, but growing in consensus because a growing number of people have continued to identify the issues at hand and want to have standard measures and standard understandings to at least be able to continue to lay that foundation.
Yeah, that's true. Because if we want to measure a phenomenon like violence in sport, for example, or maltreatment or other kinds of issues, we have to define it first of all. And if we want especially to compare those data, it will be important to have the same definitions and the same tools. So that's why it's hard for the moment to compare many prevalence data that comes out in terms of abuse or maltreatment, because there is no, it's not all the same tools that are used. It's not especially the same concept that is measured. It's not only the same population sometimes, the same period of time. Is it retrospective or is it like actual people in sport that are questioned? So there is a lot of things that differ between those samples. And we have to be very careful about this when we interpret those data and present it to the public decision makers or the person on the field.
And very quickly too, that you added a lot of context to the issues here of so you talked about, I just wrote down prevalence. Also, who is the person doing the violence? Who is receiving the violence? And then issues related to when, where, why, how, all of the sort of major questions that we're going to dig into.
Yeah, that's true. Because depending on those context, you have some kind of issue that can differ. So, for example, in the World Health Organization definition of violence, you can see inside this child maltreatment, sexual aggression, many concepts that are used, but are very specific to a context, to a perpetrator, and to a victim specifically. And in that, there is a lot of manifestation that we could enter in that. So clearly that those things are being used to transfer in item when we want to measure it. So there is the operationalization of those concepts also that is very important and sometimes tricky. Because, for example, some item destined to athletes to answer. Sometimes I like a lot of bias inside. So for example, they say, have you ever been abused? So what is abuse and how they understand it? So rather than be factual in the items, it could be kind of problematic when we ask questions like that. So there is a lot of difference between measures used.
Yeah. And we connected, Neil, a couple of years ago now about that very work. I mean, the very work that you and a few others are really doing to advance very clear understandings, clear behaviors or actions that are going to be considered, you know, violence, which was a big gap in the literature, you know, in the scientific literature, that pinning down exactly what we're talking about and not just having, and it's important to have qualitative research and open questions as well, but the field in general was missing a lack of standardized measures about to measure the prevalence of these actions. So I wonder now if you can define and talk a little bit about prevalence and what those actions, behaviors really look like, the way that you're continuing to study them.
This is a good question. So there is a lot of work on the behind that around conceptualization. So in our way of seeing it, it was important to document all the four forms that I named before. So sexual, physical, neglect, and psychological. And sometimes it differs, for example, especially when we go to physical violence versus psychological violence, because some authors will define physical violence with items like being forced to do physical exertion or physical activity. So we, in our conception, physical violence is rather an act that is physical in nature. So you you have something, you hit someone, or you push someone, you grab someone, you strangle someone. So for us, it was not part of the other. So we classified maybe differently our items. So it's difficult to compare now our results that using the VTAC with other samples where they classify, for example, those kind of example in physical violence. So when I compare to things that I can compare with one another, we have prevalence that is very like diverse. We know that psychological violence and neglect are the far most prevalent one. So we have numbers relating to 37% to 81% of athletes reporting psychological abuse or neglect during their whole career, retrospectively. So one episode or more of violence of that kind. So this is the most frequent one. For physical violence, we have data that is very also different, like 11% to 66% for physical violence. And sexual violence is a little bit less, so 14% and 38%. And we know in those data that it's a low threshold, so we didn't measure the severity of those events, and it's when they reported at least one experience. So it has to be nuanced for this part. And when we look at perpetrator, the most frequent perpetrator reported are peers. So this is the most frequent, but coaches are also in other just after peers in that kind of prevalent data.
I'm going to summarize real quick, Megan, then I'm just going to say this and please. Just so everybody can understand too, and reiterate the big points that you just said, the VTAC stands for the Violence Towards Athletes Questionnaire. So that's the standardized measurement. It's a survey. And when you said retrospectively, it means that people think back to a particular experience or period of time. And then the low threshold refers to that they have experienced such one of these behaviors or actions at least one time. And so those are the percentages that you refer to. Severity is an interesting one too, where folks are trying to qualify a little bit further, you know, because not all violence is, we'll say, created equal in the sense of if I yell at somebody, that's not the same as yelling and using a degrading terminology. It's not the same as I can think on the sexual items that penetration, forced penetration is different than a more severe event than a comment in passing or referring to a particular body part in passing. Those would not generally be considered to be the same severity. So that's how folks are trying to define severity. And then the big picture was, again, if I heard correctly, psychological violence was the number one reported prevalence, and then emotional, physical, and then finally sexual.
Yeah, that's it. You have a good summary.
Good listening. That's
and I can say also that yes, the severity could be classified around the nature of the gestures or the behaviors, but also what we don't capture for the moment really well. It's how it's interpreted by the person who have the behavior against them and what kind of consequences it have on them. So one episode of something for one people could have great big consequences and for the other, less consequences. Yep. So this is also to be taken into account. And it's why it's so difficult looking at severity in that perspective. So I know that we have in future to work on it. So to determine how we can report those data in terms of severity. Mm-hmm. So it will be very important, but it is a challenge measuring it. Yep. So I think we're not at that stage for the moment.
Well, I think we're very lucky that Dr. G has also been researching this, and I don't know, are we allowed to ask you if that was kind of similar in what you found in your recent research?
Oh, me? Ask me?
Yes, you.
Yeah. So there we have used some of Sylvie's work in some recent surveys with a US-based audience, a US-based sample. And I just got an email this morning that we are nearly finished with finally analyzing this data. And hopefully we'll have this thing under review in the next week or two, I hope. And maybe that's a little ambitious. That's typical ambitious academic talk. but in general, yeah, the we did, and this is part of what Sylvie was getting at with, you know, and I don't want to get distracted from the big picture that this is really a global problem. It needs much greater attention, focus, and a whole, when we get into mitigation or how to deal with it. The numbers that we had on a US population of about 1,400 or so responses, and then it dropped a little bit when we looked at some of the repetitive submissions. So anyway, the answer to your question, Meg, yes, sorry. Our patterns were very high. We also asked 18-year-olds all the way up, and we didn't put an age limit on it. And we just asked them about a time that they had experienced this from a coach at any point in sport. So we were looking not within, you know, let's say teenagers or college age students. It was open to 18-year-olds up and just reflecting about any time they had experienced these. So we're able to report low threshold accounts, you know, anytime that they had experienced it, as well as we'll have severity, we'll have severity reports as well as percentages for all the different categories. And they closely mirror that, but I think we might've even had higher general numbers because we asked them just about any time in sport too.
I don't know if
Sylvie, if you want to jump in too and talk about some of the items on the scale and what they're measuring, because I find too, talking with people about this stuff, that we're not, and I don't want to get distracted from the big picture of, some people say, well, that's just hard coaching, or that's just sport, or that's just
tough love.
The tough love. That's just the way it is, or it's really not that big of a deal.
Or those athletes are soft, or they're not mentally tough. You know, these are the things that I get as well when, or, you know, how someone interprets it, I think, which you said before, is very important, because how do you determine what truly is
what the effect is? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's, and there's a difference between intent and impact. And somebody might not intend to do something, but if it has the impact, it does, that's what we're getting at, right? Well, what is the impact or the acute or long-term effects of these forms of violence? Yeah.
Intention is a nice concept to look at when we talk about violence. And the World Health Organization talked about it because they take, for example, the example of the babies that we shake. So the intention of a parent in that kind of thing could be that make the baby stop crying, not to harm the baby. But at the end, this is violence. So you get my point?
Yeah.
So intentions is a concept that is very important here. It's not saying that it's not violence. It's saying that the intention could be instrumental or harmful. People want to do harm to someone else. It is possible in sport, but for many, we can see that it's all many times instrumental. So coaches, for example, could use violence. They don't really know that they use violence, but they think that they use those kinds of behaviors to reach a goal. Yeah. And those goals could be diverse. We name it a perceived effect of instrumental violence. So the goals that they can want to reach could be to test resilience on athletes, develop mental toughness, have performance more, distract for échec in English, I don't know the term. So there is many reasons to use those things, that it's not always consciously that it's violence.
Yeah, so I use this often in our shows. I'm coaching right now eighth grade football, and you know, I've been around coaches and seen coaches grab somebody by the face mask and shake them. Or, you know, you football is a contact collision sport. And so you're trying to teach, and we often use the word violence or violent in the sport, right? In our communication, like, hey, this is a violent tackle, or you have to violently strike somebody. And it's like hockey and rugby as well. And so I think part of the intent would be, and to define it, what instrumental means for folks, right? You're doing X in order to get Y, right? I'm trying to fire up an athlete in order to get them to execute a particular skill and strike somebody in a way to win the play or win the game. And so I'm trying to, but the point here is I'm connecting this to violence, in that I might be then doing something that would be considered violent or abuse, you know, to especially a youth or an athlete, a teenager, that they're going to go, wow, that I understand why the coach maybe wanted me to be tough and be physical and use this technique, but I also am like scared and frightened, and the idea of the coach used his hands and shook me violently like a baby too, struck me as not only inappropriate but a violent behavior.
There is a lot of things in there, because it's not only you instrumental relating to coach to athlete, but we also see instrumental manifestation, for example, between athletes and opponents. So the young people reported us in focus groups that they use violence and bullying in the play field because it's a technique. Yeah. So it's instrumentally internalized that we have to do that, not to be pushed or bullying in return. Yeah. So it is also a strategy of like protection, self-protection, but a strategy also to perform well and better. And sometimes is kind of dictated or encourage or passive action from people in authority looking at this or asking for this kinds of strategies. So hazing is the same. So it's an instrumental way to have cohesion, but with those kinds of violence manifestation that could be placed in hazing, it's an instrumental way. It's not to harm people, it's to make them more in the team. So there is a lot of other manifestation linking those things to instrumental impacts. And all these are very linked to values that we have in sport. So at the roots of it, there is three values that are very mentioned many times and often regarding masculinity, regarding expertise values, and also regarding performance values. So what we name sport ethics. So all those things shape people that coach, how they coach, how parents behave the same, how athletes behave, and all the people in organizations also. So the system based on those values could be problematic, and it's to see the whole system in a big picture rather than looking in silos on each type of manifestation.
What is it in the system of sport that kind of the unique characteristics of the environment that kind of lends itself to this kind of maltreatment?
It's a fairly big question also. And those values are often, as I said, in the roots of it. Mm-hmm. So if we privilege like performance in the system, it will mean that we will have those kinds of evaluation of our coaches based on performance only or near only. So where's the quality in there of interventions? So if they will be fired because they are not performance and don't bring their teams at the high levels, how we can ask them to put on quality and things like that that are not in the medal output. So this shape, all the things that we do, all the people that is inside this system. It's just an example, but we can name maybe other kinds of example of tolerance of those things. This is another factor that in the organizations are tolerant. As you mentioned, it's not perceived sometimes as violence. So people don't see necessarily it or intervene. So this is also a problem. Or when there is something happen, it's an image shaking for organization. So we don't, especially one sometimes to act, because it could be very tricky for the image or anything like that. So there is a lot of organizational issue also in depth.
Well, and the coach-athlete relationship in real life, as well as in the media, I think, it really, it's interesting to me how a lot of people will look at actions like that and be like, no, I'm motivating them. These movies where kids are transformed by having, their coach throw them up against the bleachers or the lockers and this intense moment that changes their life forever. And it's usually quite violent.
Yeah, it's valorized for this example, precisely in movies and anything like that. But when we question athletes, they don't appreciate it for the most part. So the most big reason because children or youth do sport is for pleasure, and pleasure could be manifested in children and also in adults. It's not a kind of just at children things. So having pleasure. And the other important thing is to develop abilities, competence. So when you see that, where is performance in those reasons? Mm-hmm. So that's all why the system is valorizing it so much, and why don't place more attention about the quality of experience, and know that if we place those things quite very well, maybe they will perform at the end. So there is a lot of myths also regarding the use of those instrumental violins to the performance enhancing.
Yeah.
So there is no study that say that these links exist.
I find it so interesting when coaches are not getting the response they need that they want from their players, and they've run out of their tools. They tend to get louder and more aggressive because they're kind of without another direction.
Yeah, there's a lot of issues in there because we made the constat that first, maybe sometimes they don't understand what they use in terms of its violence they use. But more than that, we need to understand that we need to train them to use other things, to use other strategies. So how we can help them do discipline. Yeah. How we can help them do training on mental toughness. What is mental toughness? How we can improve it safety in a safety bubble. Mm-hmm. So those kind of goals, if they don't have the tools, it's kind of normal that they are distressed or they seem that don't have the great response or behavior. So this is a question for us also, how we train our coaches and how we develop their capacities around those problematic things on the field.
Yeah, I'm thinking about a kid I got on my football team who's 13 years old. He's either 13 or 14. And in a football game, he got a personal foul. So he got penalized for, and I'm not going to use the language, I'll abbreviate. He told the other player, the referee came over and told me what he said. So on the field, he told one of the kids on the opposing team that I'm going to stomp your effing face.
Oh, okay.
So
that was just him getting psyched up, G.
And obviously I have a background too, right? In sports psychology and understanding of arousal or energy management. And there are some things that, right, you techniques that you can do for that, right? You can use various self-talk and breathing techniques to get yourself maybe in the right space. But if that space also includes saying things like that during the game, you're not in the right space. And despite our efforts to have young people in particular not say things like that or lose their temper during the game and get penalized. And I had a kid last week get ejected for it, for relatively mild, violent, shots during the game, where he didn't hurt anybody and it wasn't very serious. He wasn't intentionally trying to harm somebody, but it was enough that he got flagged twice and then got thrown out the game.
But wait a minute. Let's talk for a second about trash talk, because some of this stuff is taught as a psychological, psych out.
Warfare.
It does work to a point. So where does that fit in?
It does not, because I'll say it doesn't. I'll start the argument. Good. It does not fit in. And I used the word just now, psychological warfare. Mm-hmm. And if I think about masculinity and connect the dots to the military, to rulers around the world, to war and war crimes, these are usually started by and for the benefit of men. These masculine trash talking sort of things, and that carries over to girls and women's sports certainly too.
Oh, and it's evil.
Yeah.
It can get really ugly. Yeah. Boxing is one that I always think of when, you know, they do the little before press conference and they're all in each other's faces. And, you know, what there is no place for that, but yet.
And something very interesting is when I question the coaches that I train in university, and I said, why do you say that you will use bullying to train your athlete, because they will have to use it in the play field or in the playground? And I say, if you use the same kind of strategy, but you are a teacher in school, does it be permitted? Does it be accepted? And they say, no. So what's the difference here? So it's not an argument, but because if we have teachers that have problems with discipline to motivate the young people in school, do we have to trash talk to them or things like that? It will not be acceptable. So it's kind of a bubble in sport, as I can see that it's no longer the case outside and elsewhere. So when we talk about children, when we talk about young people in the workplace, it's the same thing. So a patron, the people that is in authority in your workplace that do the same to you, they will have like a penalty or something like that. Yeah. So it's just things that have to evaluate, I think. It's not good arguments.
And a lot of the sport research is based off of, or was developed out of, workplace harassment.
Yeah.
You know, so that's an interesting connection that, you know, and we know in sport, there's fewer people doing the scholarship and the research than, you know, biomedical fields and psychology in general, and bigger kind of disciplines. But when the workplace harassment became a bigger issue in the 80s and early 80s and, you know, late 80s, more and more people started to kind of think about abuse, harassment, bullying, and then it evolved into what, you know, folks are currently studying now.
Yeah. So maybe we like a little bit late and we have a lot of things to do. Yeah. And one thing that is very important and very like utopic to think about is the professionalization of our coaches. We cannot have them in part-time jobs that they have, or the many more of them, to do training in nutrition, training in psychology, training in safeguarding, training in biomechanics, training in this and this and this. It's unrealistic. So in a society that privilege that the most children and new do sport, do it well in equality, we have to have trained coaches that are trained well on this, and it would take time, and it will take like university programs as well as the teachers done in the past. So teachers before were not at university, now it is. So and they have 4 years of training to accompany our young people. So, but it's a society choice. It's a lot of money. I don't know how it could be more realistic in the future.
So is that, let's kind of pivot to prevention, mitigation strategies. Sylvie is calling for you're insisting that all coaches get a 4-year university degree that includes safe sport and violence abuse. You've heard it
here.
Not just that,
because there is a lot of links between long-term development athlete, nutrition, physiology, and how you conceive a training plan, how you have to interpersonally be conscious of what you do. It's a professional task because you're responsible of those children, and especially when they go out elsewhere with this person that is responsible, that the authority, the parental authority, when they leave with those coaches. So it's kind of a big responsibility for people. So yes, in an utopic world, I think it could be a solution.
Gee, it sounds like to me that Sylvie is asking for coaches to actually be professional, the professionalization of sport coaches.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think yes. part of the challenge is, you know, the myth that coaching is not a profession. It's not well regulated at all. And so for
that's
folks
not a myth.
Like, no, that's the reality, that it doesn't generally meet the definitions of a profession. But we continue to see, like, right. So the question, right, is, Shelby, why do we continue to see abuse? If the numbers are so high and abuse or violence is occurring at such a high rate, right, how come people aren't doing anything about it or enough about it to actually stop it?
This is a multi-level and complex phenomenon. We cannot say that just by doing this professionalization of our coaches, it will be okay. It's not the case. So as we understand the prevention, it could be global actions that we can do, but also more specific actions. So in terms of global action, looking at changing those norms and those social values linked to sport that I mentioned earlier is a big work that we have to do. And it's linked to other kinds of problematics in sport. So doping, injuries, and anything like that. So this is all things that are linked. And we often see it in silos. So if we have like those interventions that more globally, one thing. And the other thing, when we have like more specific ones. So preventing sexual violence in sport is different in my reading than preventing psychological violence. Because it's not the same mechanism, it's not the same patterns, it's not the same motivation when we talk about sexual violence than when we talk about psychological violence. So we have to have more data and more precision about each forms also, so specifically how we prevent sexual violence. So we can say like, we will do criminal background check, we will do a rule of two people always with another one, et cetera, et cetera. It's not needed that much for psychological violence because it's different. So yes, I think there is a lot of work on it.
Yeah. So tailoring the intervention or the systems and individual behavior change to meet the challenge or the problem.
This right? is one thing. It's individual because it calls also look at what we can change in terms of relationships. So relation between people, organizational also, there is a lot of prevention that we can do in the organizational things and also in the social things. So it's all responsibility for all people in sport. It's not just the case of coaches that have to be preventive or anything like that. This is the whole responsibility for everybody. I see myself as a researcher. I have a role to play in it, in the prevention. So. Each and one will be helpful in this prevention. So it's multifactorial.
Do we know of any place or organization that is doing an outstanding job of preventing violence, whether that be, you know, athlete to athlete, peer to peer, or coach to athlete? Is anybody doing this really well?
There is not that much research. It's sad, but on the evaluation of things. So we don't really know what function, what don't function, what is effective, what is not effective. We know that there is a lot of things that coming out right now, and people are doing many things. There are bystander approach, the people use more informative or awareness raising. Some will develop programs to train coaches and paramedical staff, for example. But where in the literature we have like, this is really working. And for the moment, I don't see this clearly in the literature. That is very sad. But we also have to consider that this is a fairly new research domain. So since some years that we work on it and very hard and hard, harder and harder. And for the moment, we are at the point we need to have data on what is the problem. So this is the first step. So understanding well the problem can permit to identify risk factors and protective factors. And all based on those things, we can have intervention developed and after evaluate it. So So this is why maybe we can be I don't know how to say it in English, but comprehensive on ourselves, because it's a fairly new domain, and oh, anything is so fast now, and people are need many things. We are in certain step having to take our time to do great things and evaluate what we do.
I guess, is there any advice or tips that we can give either athletes, parents, you know, coaches that are listening right now to help them navigate this space and know when to intervene and ask questions, yeah, and, you know, pull somebody out of sport or leave sport or have a conversation, a difficult conversation about these things and these concerns?
I think the thing that is the most simplest is maybe that the people have an understanding that is basic, it could be basic, of the definition of it and the manifestation of those behaviors, to see that, okay, it's not normal doing this. And when they observe it, how to intervene. And if someone can feed to them things, or they can listen in a good way, because you don't also want to create errors in testimonies after with the police and anything like that. So you don't want to contaminate the things. So how to receive people talking to us, how to intervene when we see something. So I think it's the basic things that people can do now, but it needs training or at least awareness raising on that.
Yeah. I guess I just want to ask this one just so people kind of can understand it. How many researchers in the world do you think are consistently studying violence in sport, violence and abuse, maltreatment?
I don't know, some things in my both hands, or if I had three hands, I think it could be that. If I refer to people very concentrate only on that, yeah.
So maybe, and I would have to agree that it's probably less than 15 people in the world that are doing it.
Yeah.
So what, like, and this may be the last kind of question that I have, at least we could keep going. I'm sure I could keep talking with you, but how did you get interested in this? How did you become one of the 15 that really kind of have pursued this? And this is, and I have actually over here, I have my Celia Brackenridge's books and all that. let's do it. Wait a minute. People, right. So if we're on, right? So here's my, I've got the dome right here, the Dome of Silence and a few other ones. But, you know, this, and part of why that resonates now as I'm talking is that this is heavy stuff. This is really heavy stuff to research. And and she talks about the toll that it takes personally and professionally on her as well. And so I'm just, you know, I'm curious of your own biography and your own interest in this area and how you cope and deal with it as you're enduring to read all of this stuff and do all this.
No, I'm very lucky. I'm always, people talk to me sometimes with that question. So where I was in that reflection is that I did my kinesiology and after want to continue in performance, things like that. So I went to do a master in the sport administration. And during this sport administration master, teacher and one professor present to us a documentary about sexual abuse in rowing. And I was like, no, this is not possible. It couldn't exist in sport. I was a track and field athlete and I was like, I have a positive experience and anything like that. So I was always a person that is preoccupied by justice and child protection and anything like that. So I said, okay, I will do something for that. So I will be commissioned to do that. So I start a PhD. And fast, I have the opportunity to meet Celia Brackenridge, Carrie Fasting, Sandy Kirby in the beginning of my process in PhD. So they inspire me so much. And since that time, I'm just researching that. Yeah.
And for those listening, as Sylvia just mentioned, you know, several of the pioneers and founding mothers of this research area. That have done excellent work and really prompted and set a foundation for others to build upon.
Yeah. That's true. Sylvia Breckenridge, especially, so it was so inspiring. Strong woman and very motivated, and it was like great part of her life doing those kinds of research.
There you go, Meg. Right? How does masculinity occur? By men, right? Not studying the violence and abuse that they've been doing for decades.
Yeah, I was going to say it's obvious. I was going to say something obnoxious, which was basically, you know, of course it takes a woman to point this out.
Yep.
That, you know, it's,
I don't think it is obnoxious at all.
I think it's ingrained in male behavior. So it's unfortunate. And being able to look at this topic and know that there's so much work to be done must be difficult to climb the mountain every day and yeah, try to make a difference by doing this research. So I'm very thankful that you're doing it, and it is very necessary.
Thank you. And I can say that some researchers beginning, male researchers beginning to enter in that, some were there for a moment, for like Mike Artil and Daniel Rind. But I think this is also an observation that we do in our research to see that for sexual abuse, for example, there is no difference in our studies around athletes, male athletes and female athletes in terms of prevalence. So they experience also at the same kind of level sexual abuse in sport. And it's not like known or really known. So it also is a cycle when people think it's not happening to guys or boys. So do you want to go further with that when you are a male athlete? So there is a lot of things around that that is could be very difficult for men to go and talk about it.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, as I was coming through my PhD too, I had wanted to, like a lot of folks, study great coaching and be an effective coach and be inspiring and all the great things. And then somebody at Tennessee had already started the literature on that and started that. And that was Andrea Becker, 15 years ago. And, you know, you look at the poor coaching literature, you look at ineffective coaching and you look at abusive coaching and you're like, wow, you know what? This is really where we need to be at. This is the issue. This is the social issue. And this is where people are understudying it and it's underfunded. And you can really make more of a difference rather than, you know, and you read so many studies, and how many more research studies do we need to know about something that has been studied for 50, 60 years? That's, you know, is it incrementally, is it going to do any good really? But, you know, if we can prevent violence and abuse in sport, like we're going to make a massive change to a lot of people, not just, you know, motivate one, you know, tiny fraction better or, you know, more physiology or goal setting, you know, but it's really a matter of our priorities too.
But your point is so interesting, and you received Jay Coakley, I think, in your interviews, and he said that we have tendency to say that sport is positive and although that stuff. And I face the same thing because people say, oh, we don't want to hear about that again. Can we go to the positive thing of sport? I'm like, okay, if we don't understand what happened here and we always do positive things, we will not seeing and correct it. So this is so important that we do that, but it's annoying for people that we talk about that. They prefer to see the positive side and say that we have to do all life skills and things like that. I don't want to reject life skills, but we will not prevent things by, I think, doing life skills.
Yeah.
It's different. They have different things.
No conceptualization, no definition of positive psychology, life skill development, growth mindset, whatever the popular buzzword of the day is. You can't get any of those things with violence going on.
Right.
And so if we prevented violence and abuse in the behaviors and actions where we're talking about, you're going to get better outcomes in all those other areas. And that's, you know, for the last thing, and I know you've studied this as well, that when you correlate maltreatment or violence in sport, it'll correlate highly with higher rates of anxiety, depression, suicidal ideation, And that's exactly in lower coach athlete relationship oftentimes. And that's exactly the findings that we found too.
Yeah. That's the definition of violence, because it implicates that it has consequences. Mm-hmm. And now we see that there is links with mental health issues. For the moment, however, we are not able to do a longitudinal study to see clearly that this explains this. We know there is links there,
yeah.
But one time it will be very important to causally or try to explain those links with poorer mental health and well-being.
Yeah, yeah, it's a hard thing to get research approval for as well. You can't get it. Generally, the university is not going to approve you getting in the laboratory and abusing people and testing.
No, it will not be like that. You have to be fair in your methodology. And I think it's best of all, because if you do prospective study, you can follow them. So if violence are reported between two points, you can see that you can analyze this.
Well, the longer we ignore it, obviously, the more it will grow. So thank you so much for coming. That we obviously will want to have you back and go a little deeper into each aspect of this and see how your research is going. But thank you for sharing with us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Sylvie. Next time Meg says she's going to practice her French, and so she's going to do the whole thing in French.
Oh my God.
No, Meg does not know any French. No, not going to happen.
Oui.
No.